Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. Artists matter, collaboration is key, and audience is everywhere. Those are the three guiding principles of The Contemporary, which is a nomadic, non-collecting art museum that commissions projects throughout Baltimore and implements educational programs. Dina Hagog, who received her MFA from Maryland Institute College of Art, was appointed director of The Contemporary when she was 26 years old. Dina, a native of Brooklyn and New Jersey, talked about the challenges that came with earning that job at a young age, and also about the often frustrating ways people talk about young women of color in particular, who find success when they're young. Though she didn't grow up going to museums, Dina explained how art has always been a part of her life, and about what she hopes to see in Baltimore's arts community going forward. Dina has learned a lot in these 3 years directing The Contemporary, as she's facilitated a bigger staff and budget, and she talked about how some of her perceptions of Baltimore and its communities have shifted over time. We also talked about the role of The Contemporary and the arts after the death of Freddie Gray last year. Here's my conversation with Dina Hagog. So what is The Contemporary and what do you do?
Sure. So The Contemporary is a nomadic, non-collecting art museum here in Baltimore that was founded in 1989. That means we are recognized as a museum, despite the fact that we do not have a building or a collection, and instead commission programs and projects all throughout the city with artists from all over the place. And I am the executive director there. So I sort of man the ship, but I have a pretty amazing staff. So we are five people that work pretty collectively together to get it done.
And for a while, The Contemporary was a physical building, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, it was founded in 89. And I assume somewhere around 1999 and 2000, it was doing really well enough where at that point, it was recommended that it move into a museum, which I think actually, for that moment, may have been the right choice. So it moved into this building right next door to the Walters Art Museum. They were our landlord for a decade. And in 2012, their lease was up. And that's when the Board of Trustees at that time decided that maybe we should return it nomadically. And that is what we have done.
So why do you think it works better that way? What are the advantages and disadvantages that come with having a nomadic museum?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I think in our case, the advantages sort of heftily outweigh the disadvantages. For one thing, access. I mean, Baltimore City is really small, but not everyone has access to resources to make art or access to free art programming. And that's, I define that really loosely, thinking about how different neighborhoods interpret what is a contemporary art form, how do they imagine that. But to have an entity that can move from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood and commission projects or have free lectures or publications or afford artists free resources. I mean, I think not having a building makes it so that we can go directly to our publics, you know, sort of if Muhammad won't go to the mountain will go straight to him sort of type of way. So that's been really great. And I know a lot of people like to think that by not having a building, we're saving a ton of money on overhead. And we are, but that doesn't mean we need less money, for example. So we have the same budget as we did when we were in a building, but we can utilize it and sort of direct it towards artists and towards projects pretty immediately, as opposed to, like, you know, paying rent on a massive museum or our light bill or what have you.
Sure.
You know? So, yeah. Also, it's fun for us. We just get to, like, do cool shit, like, everywhere, you know, all the time. And that's nice, you know?
So what were you doing before this job?
I was in grad school at MICA. My director at grad school at the Curatorial Practice MFA program was George Sissel, who founded The Contemporary. So I like to say that I've, like, taken over daddy's house in a way. But yeah, I mean, I was a fellow for The Contemporary right before I took on the director job. And it's been pretty great ever since. And then before that, I guess, I did do some curatorial thesis work at Gallery CA, which is housed in the City Arts Building in the Station North District in Greenmount West. So I ran that gallery for about a year and a half before I took The Contemporary over.
Where are you from originally?
New Jersey, but also Brooklyn, New York. My parents did this thing where they, like, flip-flopped between, we need to be in the city. It's not safe enough. Let's move to the suburbs. The suburbs aren't exciting enough. Let's move back to the city. But I kind of consider both places home. And my parents today live in New Jersey for the most part. So I kind of return there and think of that as home. Yeah. And I moved to Baltimore in 2011. So it's been 5 years. Yeah.
Did you like living in New Jersey or Brooklyn better?
Oh, man. I mean, they're really, really different. I really love New Jersey. I know it's like the sort of large national joke on behalf of everyone. Are you from New Jersey?
I'm not.
You're smiling like maybe you are.
No, but I'm from a state that people also find to be a national joke, which is Ohio.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's good. Oh, Ohio.
Yeah.
This year especially, there's a lot of attention on Ohio.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys had a presidential candidate potential.
We did, crazy. Whether it was O'Malley or Ben Carson or Kasich.
Everywhere you went.
Yeah, everywhere I went, it was pretty saturated.
That's hilarious. Yeah. Yeah, I love New Jersey. I love the food. I love the people. I love how ethnically diverse it is. I mean, so is New York. I mean, they're both, but I love them both. I care so much about places where you can hear many different languages at any point in time during the day. You're just like walking down the street and hear so many people conversing. That's kind of a beautiful thing. So I miss that about the New Jersey, New York region generally, which is pretty great.
Do you speak multiple languages?
I do. I speak two. I speak Arabic and English fluently. And I can make do in French, but I'm not fluent by any means. And I think I can speak Spanish, but I really just, I can't. But I like to pretend like I can. Like I feel comfortable being in Spanish-speaking situations until I realize I have no idea. We were in Mexico recently, my partner and I, and I was just speaking Spanish. And then it was sort of being brought to my attention constantly that, sure, I was speaking Spanish, but nothing I was saying was the context that it needed to be. So we'd be like at the market, and I'd be asking people what time it was, thinking that I was asking them how much things cost, sort of stuff like that. So I'm hoping to perfect my Spanish or get it somewhat decent in the next couple of years. Yeah. Do you speak any other languages?
I speak a little bit of French. Yes.
Yeah.
Way too much schooling. I should be so much better than I am. It's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
So did you grow up in a family where art was really central and important? And what was your first exposure to the art world?
Yeah. So my parents are Egyptian, sort of fresh off the boat. So I would like to think that I grew up with art as a part of our being, as a part of our family. I think that most Black and brown communities, it is just entrenched in the person that you are. Music, food, visual arts, those cultures are so inherent to the ways in which people of color, I think, operate. So yes, I grew up with a deep, profound respect for culture and for art, but the ways in which contemporary art operates in the United States, sort of this idea of museums and galleries and studio visits and art school, that was completely unfamiliar to me until I got to college. So I didn't grow up going to museums per se, or I didn't even know art school was a thing until I had gotten to college and I went to Rutgers, which is a state school in New Jersey, the Newark campus. So I didn't even realize that those were options. And I'm glad that I do, and I'm hoping that to some extent, you know, moving forward, that communities of color have more access to the way that the art world operates in the United States. And then I also hope that the art world is better informed by the ways that art and culture can operate in communities that aren't, you know, used to museums and contemporary art in the way that it is now. I know it's kind of a long-winded, weird, backwards answer, but
yeah. No, it makes sense. Yeah. Did you feel like you had to play catch-up a lot, just not having that foundation, you know, not growing up with like artist parents, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I just, I think that I am not an artist also. So I don't make anything, right? I feel really passionately about arts administration. I feel really passionately that I am a builder in the arts economy of things, but I'm not an artist. So I feel like not being an artist, not growing up around sort of traditional artists in that way, not having them as parents or sort of elders in my community, I feel like I don't always know what it's like to be in the mind of an artist. And the contemporary has a lot of artists on staff. Almost our entire staff is artists. And I sort of lean on that a lot, that they know firsthand what that experience is like to be making something and unsure, or making something and positive, or the weird way that artists can abstract time when they make a thing. Whereas I feel like I'm more spot on with the like, this is what needs to get done, and this is how we sell the thing, and this is how we promote the work that this artist is doing. So yeah, I feel like I'll always be playing catch up, because I don't occupy that mindset necessarily. But I love them. I mean, I love being in the mind of an artist, and I almost kind of enjoy the fact that I'm not one and can see it from a different vantage point, maybe.
You know? Yeah, I feel like kind of an outsider's perspective might be beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine you go through the same thing. You write like review music, and are you a musician?
I'm not. No, and I actually don't review it. Just interview some bands and stuff. But yeah, there's definitely some catch up if you didn't grow up in a family who was reading the news all the time, or you know, you didn't know writers or something like that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Did you have writers in your family?
No.
Wow. No, all more on the sciencey side. So,
when did you know you wanted to be a writer?
Most of my life. Yeah,
that's crazy. That's amazing.
Still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. I guess.
I think we're all in that boat. Yeah.
So you got this job when you were 26, right?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, how is that possible?
I have no idea. I think honestly, it was just the right place at the right time, and it'll never happen again in my entire life that things will line up in that way. It's like all the stars just aligned. It was good and bad for so many reasons. I feel so grateful to the like board that hired me against probably all of their best judgments at that time. I feel so grateful for the folks that mentored me to get me to feel like I could take that job, like such a responsibility at 26. And I think that I had no idea then what I was doing, and I had no experience in the nonprofit sector in that way. So I think to some extent it allowed me to take risks when I didn't know that that's what was happening, because I didn't know what the norm was to then compare against it per se. But with that said, I mean, also it was hell a little bit, you know? I mean, I think that women generally have a hard time in leadership positions because the world wasn't designed with that in mind, and we're watching that kind of break right now. I think in addition to that, the world was not designed to have people of color in positions, so that was one layer of it. And then the final part of that was sort of this ageism, right? Like there was this sense that that played in a lot in two different ways, in ways that people thought there was no way I could get this done because I was so young, and or they sort of fetishized it, you know, like, oh my God, she's so young. And we received so many opportunities, I think, because of that. So I think I try to keep that in mind now when I'm not, you know, by any means that much older, but I'm 29 now and I'll be 30. And I think about that a lot when I see people in their early and mid 20s in the field and remembering how isolating it felt, and also how much it boosted my ego in a way that wasn't real, maybe, you know? Mm-hmm. And to try to remind myself, like, it's about the work, you know? And even though it's like a young, you know, body of color in that space, like, it's still about the work. And to try to remember that, even though the whole world only wants you to pay attention to, like, those things, you know, and sexualize you, like, in that way. So,
was there a pushback because of your age, or was it just more of those frustrating tropes you'd hear?
There was a little bit of pushback, but I feel very blessed that the majority of it was extremely positive. And the pushback is nothing that I think, I'm very honored that it's nothing that the board or our funders or anybody necessarily like took into consideration, which is pretty rad. And then a part of me was also just like, yeah, take your haters. And like, I was listening, I've made this joke before, like I was listening to so much rap, just being like, yes, like amp yourself up, take your haters, like rereading all the mean emails even more to like motivate myself to do this better. So I think oddly, sometimes when there is backlash, it's like motivating in a weird way.
Sure.
You know, you just want to like disprove like all those people who didn't think that you could do it.
It seems like at least locally, there are quite a few women in positions of power in the arts. Is that true?
Yeah, definitely.
Why do you think that is here? And what, you know, what barriers in the art world are women still facing?
Yeah, I'm not really sure why that's the case in Baltimore, but I love it and I hope it doesn't change. But there are a number of women that occupy really powerful positions in the cultural sector here, which is wonderful. I think there's still a tremendous amount of barriers for women. I mean, if you look at the data, I guess, I mean, women are still an underwhelming minority in this field, especially in leadership positions. I think that I hear sometimes that we're past this point where women have a fine time getting along, and it's just not true. I mean, so many of these infrastructures are designed for men, and people are used to seeing men in the room. So small examples, even, I mean, even now, if I have one of my male colleagues or a male intern or a male somebody on our staff in any capacity with me at a meeting, I'll watch that person get looked at more than myself, even with women. I mean, I think it's just the way we're trained is to sort of assume that if there's a man in the room, that's the point of authority. So that's a thing to definitely take in mind. I think that there's so much emphasis still on the way women dress and look and behave in a way that's just not, I mean, I think we saw that so much so in this sort of Sanders versus Clinton time where it was like, I love me some Bernie Sanders, but that man is a mess. Like on stage, he's just like, his hair is wild. His suits are always like one size too big. And like, no one focuses on this thing. But if Hillary Clinton has like one hair out of place or says, you know, she's like a color that's not maybe the most fitting for her complexion, it's like on, it's news, you know? And I think we see that thing all the time. So I think that women in all sectors deal with this, and it still exists in the arts today. I also watch a lot of like an Amazonian beautiful woman has taken over this museum, and like a man's looks would never be taken into consideration when he takes a new job. So things like that. And when I first got my job, I noticed that my age was such an issue. And I had a couple of friends male friends who had also taken over nonprofits when they were fairly young, and it was never a point of conversation, or it wasn't told like some crazy success story, as if like despite all the odds, this young man has managed to find this place. You know, it was right. More like, we need to help this young man and mentor him. This is the future of Baltimore, the next leaders. And I was never referred to as like a next leader. It was just more like, oh wow, this like prodigy child, and how could she have slipped through the cracks? And I think that happens to women and minorities more so than like white men, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
what was the state of the contemporary when you took over in 2013, and where is it now?
So the programming had ceased for about a year and a half when I had taken over. The board was still active. There was about 6 or 7 people that were meeting regularly to determine the future. It had a super small budget, literally $40,000, and absolutely no staff or plans. It didn't even know at that point if it wanted to move back into a building, remain nomadic, or close entirely. Today, so roughly 3 years later, we have gone from a $40,000 budget to a $500,000 budget. We've gone from 0 staff, or just myself, to 5 folks on staff. We had no programs then. Today, we almost have 10. We had no real goals in 2013. Now we know, like, we want to be nomadic. We're proudly nomadic. We're not interested in moving into a space. And we also have a small office that we operate out of the Bromo Arts District on the corner of Utah and Franklin. So it's changed pretty drastically, much to the testament of our entire sort of motley crew of folks.
Was the learning curve steep when you took over?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Real steep. I think I'm, like, still sore from having to like, make it up that damn hill. Yeah, it was crazy. I didn't know anything. I would say the hardest part of it actually was 2 things. It was thickening my skin to not be upset or nervous when things were sort of thrown at me that maybe weren't my fault or were my fault, but to deal with criticism in a very, very real way. And then the second part, as mundane as it sounds, is like accounting. Like, I didn't know anything about accounting. Numbers bore me terribly, and I had to figure out a way to like balance a budget and use QuickBooks. And our treasurer, Jessica Lanzalotti, who's still our treasurer today, has been like my saving grace and has really sort of put me through this crash course of like how to get this thing down really quickly. But man, that is some boring, crazy, tedious work. And if you don't master it, it will just, there's no point. You know, it is just like the foundation of this work, which is something that kind of took me by surprise.
But what else has surprised you about the job? And have there been any parts you've really enjoyed that you didn't know you had a knack for previously?
Yeah, I mean, this job has definitely made me put my foot in my mouth a lot. There was a moment where I had completely underestimated the sort of inequities that exist in certain communities in Baltimore. I had underestimated where certain neighborhoods are really well resourced for sort of specifically to culture, and certain ones are not. The ways in which some artists are funded and some aren't. And it's really taught me a lot about holding space for lots of different art forms, and holding space for the ways that lots of different communities can define what it is that is culturally relevant and important to them. I mean, I think something about being in the contemporary art world as it is defined implies that you're some kind of expert on something, as opposed to realizing that maybe the thing we need to be experts on is just looking and really seeing what is around us. So I think when I first had this job, I was so tunnel visioned into like my taste, what I thought was important for the times. And about a year and a half in, it dawned on me that if it doesn't matter to the people that see it, what is the point of it, really? You know, and to sort of look around me at the people in Baltimore and what they were making and doing, and how that can inform the way that the institution functions. And also, that first year, I was alone for a lot of it. And when we hired a staff, I mean, it totally shifted the way that we thought about this place, because it wasn't just me anymore. And we had to take all these different voices into consideration. And they brought with them a breadth and a responsiveness to their worlds that was so important to the contemporary today. So I think it's just made me better at like looking and seeing, and not so much deciding on like what is important and what is not.
Well, one of the core tenets of the contemporary is that audience is everywhere. Mm-hmm. Who is the Baltimore art audience? How much of a demand is there, and what do people want here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the demand is huge. So for example, just a really small quick thing, we have this lecture series that we host at the BSA, and we have regularly pulled in 500 to 600 people to go to an artist talk. So I feel like the hunger for this is not small. I mean, people want this work. People want access to this work. So that is huge. With that said, I mean, I think that a lot of communities and audiences in Baltimore may not necessarily know one another, interact, or have a need to interact regularly. I think we've seen that shift a lot over the last year and a half as a direct result of the work of many amazing community organizers in town. But when we say audiences everywhere, I mean, I think we think about that in a number of ways. It can be that we're making a project specific to a kind of audience, and that is the one that we are primarily after, or projects where we're like, these are two audiences that may never have a reason to interact, and how can we bring them together? Or we even think sometimes about like the audience of one, like what is it to consider each individual in town and what their needs are, or sort of what their interests are in culture. So I think when we decided that that was such an important value for us, we thought it gave us space and freedom to think about audience in whichever way was needed for the museum at whatever time in the past or in the future. So that stayed pretty true, at least for these past 3 years, that we've continually thought about audience in that way. And also remembering that not everything you do is going to appease everyone or appeal to everyone, and that that's okay too. You know, like it's okay to try new things and do different things.
How does the outside arts community view Baltimore? And are you concerned with that view?
No, I'm not concerned at all with that view, actually. I think that the caliber of work happening in Baltimore, if we compared it nationally, is extremely high. I think that there has always been an interest in Baltimore. I think it's grown fairly substantially since the uprising last year, which I think we all saw coming. I think that my thoughts on this is that there are a lot of really big and really powerful cultural institutions in town, and cultural organizers and small galleries. I mean, the ecosystem is wide and it is varied. Sometimes I worry that we are not operating holistically, that each person is sort of so concerned with what they're doing, and we fall into this trap too, we're not excluded from it, that we're so concerned with what we're doing that we forget to sort of consider the field and the landscape locally much largely. And the reason I say that is I think if we did that, we would have an easier time really promoting what's happening in Baltimore to the rest of the country and world. So I feel like there's this disconnect a little bit between like all the amazing things that artists are doing here and the ways in which they have miraculously, frankly, really built an ethos and a culture that is important. I mean, I think we have one of the best music, visual arts, performance, and theater scenes in the country. Like, I really do. And I am phenomenally well-traveled. You know, like, my job makes it so that I am constantly in other American cities, if not cities, all over the world. And I will stand by that, that what is happening here is remarkable. And now I wonder if it's time, really, and it's been time, for the institutions to find a way to resource that work better so that it has a larger platform to sort of promote itself. And so sometimes I sit there and I'm like, how are we not getting this right? How are all the resources here and the institutions are here? And then all the talent, the hard work, the work ethic, it's all here. And what is disconnecting us that we can't all seem to get this right? And then a part of me wonders if, or I can't help but think about all the ways in which if things became better resourced, how would that change the thing to begin with? You know, like how does music and art change if it gets more and more, you know, sort of resources? But we take this thing extremely seriously at the Contemporary. In the beginning, when we restarted, we had only been thinking about public programs, projects, speaker series, publications. And about a year in, we were like, we need to help artists. I mean, artists are doing it. They're doing it better than we'll ever do it, right? So then that's when the thinking started coming about, we need to establish a grants program. We need to establish a studio visit program. We need to find ways for artists to connect to professionals nationally and globally so that their work can continue to be promoted. And that's really taken off. So the need is absolutely here. And I think Baltimore is like, what is it? It's just like, just add water. Like at this point, it's here. Like people just need to sort of add the water for it to bloom into, this is like a terrible analogy. It's really, I'm like saying it and I'm like, this is, but yes, I think we need to add water for it to bloom.
Sure.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I mean, just myself being an outsider, it seems that Baltimoreans very much enjoy their outsider status also, and it gives the city like a good rebellious spirit.
Yeah. I mean, it feels kind of lawless in a way, in a way that is good and bad. I used to joke that it felt like there was like no lifeguard on duty in Baltimore. Like you could just like do, I've made that joke so many times at this point, and every time I make it, I'm like, nope, still true. When did you move here?
A year and a half ago.
Oh, wow. You are like brand new.
Yeah.
You like it?
I love it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How, where did you
And I would agree with the lifeguard analogy.
Yeah, it's just like you can get stuff done. Also, Baltimore, I used to say this actually a lot, that you can meet anybody you wanted. You have access to the mayor's office. You have access to pretty much anybody, really. I mean, if you really put your mind to it. And then I realized that in and of itself is this like insanely privileged thing to say. And when I realized that I had access to all these things and lots of folks I spend time with do, that's there's an entire section of the city that maybe does not, what are ways to make it so that everybody had access, you know, and had a voice. So that's been like a nice sort of, oh shit, like the past 2 years, it's been like, oh, it's our job actually. This Baltimore we all think we inhabit that is open and friendly and accessible and you can come here and make yourself happen. I mean, it is not the case for everybody, right? But if you feel that way, it is sort of on you to now find a way to push that out, you know? So that's been an interesting thing to realize. So yeah, there's no lifeguard on duty, but not everybody's at my pool, right? And I need to like get everybody to my pool so that we can have fun. I am just like killing it in the bad analogies.
So you can just have the best like contemporary pool party of all time.
With no lifeguards.
Yes.
Lots and lots of snacks.
Well, I would actually like to go back to the uprising.
Yeah.
In the aftermath of Freddie Gray's death, did you find your role changing? And what is the role of the arts, you know, in a post-Freddie Gray Baltimore?
I think I read something on the internet, actually, you know, that has stuck with me for the past day and a half. It said that things are not getting worse. They are becoming uncovered. We must hold each other tightly and continue to pull back the veil, or something along those lines. And that sat with me because I think it resonated so much with how I see the work and how I want to see our work continue in a way. When Freddie Gray died last year, when he died in police custody, I mean, I think that I don't think that I was surprised. I also want to comment, because it might be a little bit important to remember this, that as we sort of talk about this thing. So my family is Egyptian, and I was living in Cairo when the Mubarak regime was overthrown. So that was sort of my first relationship to this kind of unrest and this kind of uprising from the people. And Cairo was really beautiful in certain ways and really terrifying in others, right? Like the level at which protest was happening was fast, at times violent. It was loud and it was scary. And it was a country where literally its government shut off, right? Its police force closed, and it became militarized really quickly and extremely unsafe for a lot of people, especially artists who were, you know, on the front lines of recording what was happening. And then, you know, so a few years later, I'm now living in Baltimore. It is sort of my second go at this thing. And all of the mechanisms of it were the same, you know, like it felt so similar in a lot of ways. And something about that was a little heartbreaking, right? That like all over the world, people are not satisfied, right? With their officials, they're not satisfied with their government. They're not satisfied with the people that are meant to lead them and keep them safe. In terms of the cultural sector, I think that artists have always done this work. I think that they have always been on the front lines of racial progress in this way. I think that they are interested in getting better always, right? So that is a beautiful thing about the arts largely. The ways in which I saw artists in Baltimore respond to the uprising, to immediate needs of various communities throughout the city, was stunning. Like, it was absolutely beautiful to see artists just know what to do, pick up, make space for people to be heard. I mean, it was a very, very, very beautiful thing. With that said, has it shifted our role? Yes, of course. I mean, I think it's shifted the entire city. I think it's sad to know that people are so much more, the traumas in which our communities live with are so much more apparent now, right? Like across racial lines, economic lines. And I think to some extent, it's the contemporary's job to make sure that we are present for that and that it is reflected in the work that we do. And as you can see, I haven't quite figured out how I feel about this thing, but I know that there are so many different people living in the city. And by nature of our nomadic operating, we have access to a lot of them, and that they may not necessarily have access to one another. And what we saw happen last year was people be forced into proximity with one another in a way that was more beneficial than not. And something about that is inspiring. And with that said, I want to remember that people will naturally go back to the order of things pretty quickly, like when the immediate trauma sort of subsided, and remembering that art can agitate in a way that is productive and that we need to be on the forefront of that agitation. Like, we need to remind people constantly that we need to keep these issues, you know, issues of police brutality and government in our minds, you know? Does that make sense?
Definitely.
Sorry, that was really long.
And It seems that I was looking at some of the Grit Fund recipients, mm-hmm. and a lot of those did have kind of like a social justice bent to them. Is that something you...
No, I mean, I would not say that that was something that was unique to the uprising. I mean, also last mm-hmm. year we did a speaker series that focused so much on thinking of a lot of those issues, and that was planned long before sort of Freddie Gray was arrested. That, I mean, those are things that... No, I mean, I think that that has always been the spirit of this place. It was sort of the way that it was founded. It is definitely an ethos that each individual staff member and board member and council member carries with them, and it just manifests in our work. I think the difference is that, I think the difference was a couple of things, is that the Contemporary has a pretty decent national reputation, or in the very least we're known, right? So I think one thing that we noticed was happening after the uprising was a lot of folks nationally were calling our office. What is going on? How are you doing? Is the media to be trusted? And it dawned on us, oh wow, we're also, like, we think of ourselves as a platform for the citizens of Baltimore, and we kind of forgot for a minute, we also represent the citizens of Baltimore to the rest of the country. So there was this moment where we were like, how do we talk about this thing, right, in a way that is honorable and honest, right, without sort of romanticizing it or fetishizing it in any way. So that's a very real thing. And then the second part of it was just all of a sudden it was the thing everyone wanted to talk about. And because we are in a nonprofit and because we exist in this sort of nonprofit complex of other nonprofits, we are really attached to fundraising and we are really attached to a kind of system that sometimes really wants a quick fix. Right. So all of a sudden people are waking up and they want to fund things and they want to help things and everything's really fast. And how do you put yourself in a place where you want to keep your nonprofit alive? So of course you're sort of thinking about ways to accept money and to keep the wheels rolling, but also you're in this place where you're like, there is no quick fix to this thing. And how can you educate your public, but then also work alongside your funders to remind people, like, if we are committed to this work is long, right? And we need to think really holistically about how we're going to fix parts of the city. There is not a check you can write to all of a sudden make people's pain go away. There's not a check you can write to make people forget their trauma. You know, like, that is not going to happen. We need real sort of systemic shifts. So I think we realized, okay, so on one hand, we represent Baltimore nationally. And on the other hand, we sort of accidentally and intentionally represent Baltimore people's needs to the funders that think they're funding them, right? So, like, how do we do that in a way that feels not gross, right? And, like, mm-hmm. actually helpful. So those were all things we were, like, reckoning with last year. And I think we feel comfortable, but the work is not done, right? And we're still kind of doing it. But yeah, I love the Grit Fund grantees. I love the range. Like, the applications we get are so broad and so wonderful. And it reminds us again, like, we're in a really diverse ecosystem. Lots of different artists are living here. And how can we be a place that represents and is in conversation with every single one of those artists, right? From the folks doing social justice work to the folks who are doing things that maybe are not so overtly activist, you know, but very, very important to the ways that we think about recording our humanity and having conversations about what it was like to be here in this time on this planet, you know? So all of those things we're kind of trying to carry in the same basket.
Especially being well-traveled and coming from Cairo to Baltimore and experiencing mm-hmm. all these uprisings and all this unrest, I mean, is it difficult to stay hopeful and optimistic?
No, I think if anything, and this is like a really ridiculous thing to say, I don't feel hopeless. I feel sad. Like, I feel like, and again, this is like the probably the most trite word I can use, but there is a kind of idiocy in the ways that we think about our governing bodies globally that, like, kind of are baffling me at this point. Like, it's almost so ironic and so funny that it's like bad or something. Like, I can't believe that we can't get this right. Like, I cannot believe that it is 2016, that we have more media and more forms of communication and more technology than we have ever had, that people have proximity to each other in a way that is unbelievable and truly remarkable, and we cannot figure this thing out, right? That you can record officers and still not hold them accountable to their actions, that people can speak across cities and states and governments and countries, and we still can't find ways to, like, actually understand one another or have a better sense of, like, basic geopolitical power structures, right? Like, so I'm not hopeless in a way that's like, oh my God, are we ever going to get out of this? I'm getting more and more sad and mad at the idiocy of it. You know, like, I don't know what else people need to, like, figure this thing out. And I think now, especially with sort of the Trump, you know, sort of the Trump being the forerunner of the Republican Party, I mean, it's just sort of like, oh my God, like, how did we get here we've always, I guess, kind of been here in a way, and what are infrastructures to make sure that people just have more knowledge, right, or something. I don't know. I haven't quite figured this thing out yet, but I'm just enraged, you know, at that thing. Yeah, are you hopeful?
I'm very cynical. Yeah, I don't think I've ever met a hopeful journalist, though.
So. That's probably one of the better things I've heard all week. Yeah, that's probably very true. Yeah, I guess what you guys are on the front lines of this thing. You're just like out behind every story.
Well, yeah, and I'm not one of the breaking news reporters or anything. They're really the ones out there. But yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to read and produce news all day long and stay hopeful about anything. I mean,
it's difficult to sit back and watch the news all day long and stay hopeful.
Exactly.
About
I don't think anyone wants to be doing that, but here we are.
Yeah.
What direction do you want to steer the conversation about arts in Baltimore?
I mean, I want to steer a conversation towards a place where artists don't feel removed from the communities that they live in. I think oftentimes when we talk about the arts or artists in particular, we treat them like they are other from, like they are different from the places they inhabit. They are different from the people they commune with on a daily basis. They are different from the world around them. And that's just not true. I mean, artists are integrated into every industry on this planet. They are doing things in science and policy and government. They are doing things across different mediums in dance, visual arts, music, performance. They are doing things at every budget, in every city, in every community, in every state. So I feel like I want to steer this conversation into a place where artists are treated with the same amount of dignity and respect as every other profession in this country, and that they are not seen as sort of like oddballs or the odd man out. And that, you know, I think that artists should be in every city agency. You know what I mean? I think that they bring with them a way of thinking about the world and a kind of sensitivity to the world that is obviously extremely needed right now all over this place. So that thing is really important to me, and I want to continuously steer it that way. And I think that artists should not, you know, when recently I met with a young woman in town, and I asked her, you know, if she had work tomorrow. We had a meeting and she needed some stuff, and she went, oh yeah, I mean, I make a living off my work, implying like she doesn't necessarily have this like day job that I need to accommodate her schedule. And it dawned on me how surprised I was to hear that, and that should not be the case, right? Like, we should not be sitting here thinking if artists are making livings off the work that they do, that that is a surprise, right? That should be the norm, and plenty of other countries have figured out a way to make that the norm. And I think for a place that's as culturally dense as the United States, that that is really important. We have so many different people of different skin colors, different languages, different religions and races all living in this country. So I think it is imperative here that we support our artists, because I think it is the thing that sort of brings people across those lines and really builds a kind of understanding for one another. So other countries that have great arts funding and are really homogenized, that's lovely. But I think we would see a benefit from that so much more so, you know, to like record people's voices as they exist. And then there wouldn't maybe be so much fear from one another, you know, across all these lines. So I'd love to know that our work as a collective and then my work individually is all steering us towards this place. And then I like kind of working for an organization that is so committed to sharing resources with the underrepresented. Like, I love that for the most part, I would say 99% of our operating is with, you know, female artists or artists of color or, you know, queer artists, that we're building a space to sort of highlight folks that have traditionally not necessarily been appreciated by the canon historically. You know, like that thing is like, I feel really good about that thing, you know.
And you work with students also, right?
We do. Yeah, we have an internship program that's pretty much for college-age students. We're launching a youth program in the fall that'll be for middle school-age students. And we're trying to establish another sort of program for high school students, but we're still working that out. But yeah, we love our work with students. And we run our speaker series out of the Baltimore School for the Arts, so we have a lot of access to them, which is great. Yeah, I love students. Students are amazing. Students, sometimes the conversations I have with teenagers that I have to interface with for the contemporary feel smarter than most adults I talk to. I don't know what it is. I feel like maybe they've just had access to media for pretty much their whole lives and have been able to form opinions that are based in fact and evidence more so than their like crazy ramblings. But something about students today feels so tempered and wise, like they just get it. And I hope that as soon as they're old enough to take over, that we give them the grace and the space to do so, because I see so much more hope in them than kind of the rest of us out here, like trying to figure this thing out.
Yeah, I feel like it's always like, rah, 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 teens and their selfies are awful, but they are so much smarter than we were and
totally
so informed, and maybe not just parroting their parents' opinions.
Yeah, it's It's amazing. Nice. And the few that are, I feel like they have more friends, or more, maybe not friends, they have more people in their circles or in their lives to call them out on it than maybe I did growing up, and I'm sure generations before ours did growing up. So I think that thing is important, you know? Mm-hmm. I like that kids protest, you know? I like that kids know when they're being lied to, they know when they're being conned, and they are willing to stand up for themselves in a way that's kind of amazing. Yeah, and after seeing what happened to our students last year in Baltimore during the uprising, the ways that their identities were constructed for the media was, like, appalling, right? And to know that they knew, like, they knew that they were being manipulated, and they knew that they were being portrayed as these, like, thugs and criminals in a way that was just false, right? And it was so nice to see them be like, this is bullshit, and I hope that they carry that ethical line with them into their work, you know, because it's what will sort of demolish that eventually.
What haven't you accomplished yet with a contemporary that you'd like to, and what are you most proud of accomplishing so far?
Oh, there's so much that we still have to do. So much. I mean, this work is hard. I mean, running the contemporary is hard. It is an extremely labor-intensive and intellectually intense experience. So I'm always looking for ways not to make it more comfortable, but to make it so that all of the people that have to come on board to make this place work, feel really appreciated, right? So that, I don't know, that's more like a personal long-term goal. I think the thing I'm the most proud of and the thing I would like to grow on within reason is the ways that it's created jobs, right? Like, we have fairly decent, I mean, we have really great jobs in contemporary art in a city the size of Baltimore with decent salaries and benefits, et cetera. And something about that feels truly remarkable to me. And it is so much a testament to the folks who fund us, to our board who advocates for us, and to the staff that continues to justify the work, right? Like, that is an amazing thing. I would like to keep growing that thing. Like, I would like to know that we can create more and more jobs in the sector and in the field here, because I think that they are needed without completely hemorrhaging the organization to some extent. So I don't think the work there is technically done, but I'm very, very proud of where it is as of now. In terms of programming, I mean, we haven't reached out to every neighborhood yet. You know, we haven't made contact with every community. I mean, there's still literally so much ground to cover. But I think it feels like we've been in an experimental phase for 3 years, like kind of throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks, like really sort of deciding what feels right and what doesn't, and letting ourselves work on our intuition, which has been really, really beautiful, and not a thing that enough organizations, I think, let themselves do, which is like trusting their gut and not need necessarily like metrics and proven goals to like do a thing. So I want to figure out a way to pass it on. We're not going to be here forever, the staff that's here now. And how do you pass it on to like the next team with that spirit still very much intact, right? Like, let yourself do things because you know they're right. And you don't know how to vocalize that they're right. And maybe funders are looking at you like you're insane. And maybe at times your board is a little worried, but they know to stand by you because they've trusted you so far. But you're doing things because you just know that it is right. And when it's done, it'll justify itself. And that's been beautiful. And I think a lot of that is because we were so young and had no idea what we were doing. So people were following us, but now we're starting to establish in a way that I'm worried that that part might disappear. And how do you like keep that together, you know? And I think that that is just so, especially in the arts. I mean, if you're not doing things in the arts because you know that they're right, I mean, what industry do you get to do that in, right? Like, it just is what feels like it needs to be, you know?
Well, I think that's a good place to end. Dina, thanks so much.
Thank you. Yeah, it was great to be here. Thank you so much.
Listening to Female Trouble. You can find this podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or any of the other major podcast apps. We're also at BaltimoreSun.com and SoundCloud.com. Female Trouble is on Twitter at FML Trouble. If you like this podcast, feel free to give us a rating on iTunes. Our theme music is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's TT the Artist. Thanks again, and see you next time.